great start. The Conference Committee on House File 829 will come to order. Today, for the record, is Thursday, April 29th, and it is 9 p.m. Thank you all for being available at this unpleasant time of the night. We'll try to make it as pleasant as we can and get people out of here so they can go home. We're going to start with the corrections budget, and I thought we would start with this, the commissioner or assistant commissioner coming and talking to us about the salary supplement, and we have different numbers, and please talk to us about that. Assistant Commissioner Benson, whenever you're ready.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Dennis Benson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Institutions Division at the Department of Corrections. And I know that we have had numerous conversations through session regarding the compensation adjustment for our agency. As you know, the governor plugged in a number of $30.9 million for our agency, which just funds what we refer to as across-the-board increases, the retirement piece, insurance increases, and step increases. In the institutions division, that has been funded at 4.25%. And the actual number is just a wee bit higher than that over the 08-09 biennium, but that's what's in the budget, that's what we can live with. In the community services division, it's also funded at 4.25%. And again, the actual increases, when you add up the across-the-board retirement, insurance, and step increases, comes to a little bit more than that. In the operations support area, which would be our central office, it's 2% in the governor's budget, and again, the actual cost is a little bit over 3%, 3.5%. And the reason these numbers are difficult to nail down is, remember that we deal with 8 different contracts and 2 plans, a manager's plan, a confidential plan. The provisions are a little bit different with respect to who gets raises when. Junior employees get annual increases. Once the employee gets to the top of the range, they don't get an increase. But I need to tell you that these numbers, these percentages, are not average. We actually plug in all of our personnel so we know who is going to get a step increase, who isn't, and of course, everybody is entitled to that across the board. As we've explained during session, in the CERP Corrections Early Retirement Plan, the state's share of retirement was increased to try to make that retirement post-plan payroll. There's a problem there in terms of it being underfunded, so it was adjusted last year. Both the employee and the state have to pay a little bit more. In addition to the 8 plans, the state's obligation for retirement is harder or a little bit higher. We really think we're a little bit short here, but again, we fund our institutions at 97-98%. And there are some things that have occurred that I want to remind committee members of the last 6, 7, 8 years that are significant and why we see this as our highest priority. Number one, in the last 11 years, our population inside of our institutions has doubled. 98% increase, I believe. In the field, the number of people on supervision has increased dramatically as well. We have gone from 50% double bunking in our institutions to over 80% double bunking in our institutions. We have double bunked at Stillwater and St. Cloud, which we continue to be nervous about. So we've pushed the envelope inside of our facilities as far as we dare push them. And as we converse about the programming, the reentry initiatives, the additional supervision enhancements, they are all well and good, but the reality is we have to fund our base, we have to keep our base whole before we can add any more trinkets to this animal. And that's why we see this as such a high priority. It's $30 million, $30.9 million to get those numbers, 4.25, 4.25 in institutions, community service, and 2% in operation support, which again, I need to remind you, is a little bit less than what we believe reality will be once the contracts are negotiated. State has more or less put that 2% across the board on the table. The reality is those contracts will undoubtedly come in at least at that number, if not a wee bit higher. And there's training costs as we have turnover that are not part of this. As we've discussed in committee, we also have the issue of retiree insurance. We did get a line item appropriation, or at least it's in the bill as we speak right now, to deal with that issue, but we're starting to see more and more people retire as well. So there's no room to suck this up, so to speak, and there's no fat in our agency. And I need to tell you that back in 2001, 2002, we went through a per diem reduction, but almost $20 million, 200 positions. Then along came the budget crisis, and we left $55 million on the table. We did a lot of double bunking. So, again, we have to make our base budget whole before we move forward with some of these other initiatives. If we don't, the money will start to, it'll filter down to that cell block level anyway, an agent on the street level, because we simply have to ensure the health, safety, and of our staff and offenders. So that's the short explanation.
Okay. That's
the
short explanation?
That's the short explanation.
Okay. Commissioner Benson, does this amount include new hires at all?
It anticipates the number of positions that we have on the roster, yes. It would, for the new people coming in, we take a snapshot when we run these numbers, so it anticipates that X number of positions will be filled. And again, we fund...
Can you tell us how many that is, please?
Well, it varies from year to year, but I can tell you that our line level turnover is somewhere... It swings between 8 and 11%.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell me how many current staff positions that you have vacant, and do you intend to fill all of them this year, and how long will it take you to fill them?
I can't give you the precise number how many we have vacant, but I can tell you when we have a vacancy, we sign a what we call a transitional transaction form to fill the position. So we are not holding a lot of positions open, but occasionally we do. And again, understand that we're funded at about 97% to 98%. So we're always in a business where we have 4,000 employees. You're never going to have them all filled at any given time. There's probably going to be a couple hundred positions open, but they're always in process of being filled. So we're only funded at that 97 or 98%. And if we don't get this 4.25 in our institutions, I can tell you the first thing we'll do is we'll fund institutions at 95 or 96%, so that margin gets bigger, and then we have to hold positions open even longer. And that's when it gets dangerous in those facilities, and we have trouble complying with program standards. We have trouble keeping the chemical dependency positions full, the security positions full, casework positions full. There are retirements. Somebody announces a retirement. It takes, they might give a two-week notice, but it might take 30 days to get the position filled. So there's a little bit of it takes some time to fill positions in government.
All right. questions on the salary issue? Oh, Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Like 200 or 100, between 100 and 200 employees would be considered full complement when you consider transition. Do you have any of those vacancies also in administration or high-level positions, and about how many?
I would say percentage-wise probably about the same. Yeah, at any given time, it might be even greater than that. I can tell you that we didn't have somebody in our communications office for about 6 or 8 months this past year. We've had positions open in our community services division for a number of months, management level positions. So it's not unusual that those positions would be it would take the same amount of time to fill if there are vacancies. We have problems finding nurses, keeping nurses. That's a professional group that we have a great deal of difficulty recruiting and hiring.
Madam Chair, I have other questions, but not on the staffing.
Okay. Any other issues on the staffing? Representative Palmer.
I'm going to probably call you guys Senator all night, so let me apologize in advance.
Commissioner Bassett, I just want to clarify the 4.2% increase. So is that for corrections across the board, or is that just for institutions?
Mr. Chair, that is for the institutions division and the community services division, the agents in the field, and it's 4.25%.
Representative Palmer.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, so the and the rationale for community service, community corrections getting the 4.2%.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative Palmer, we took a look at they're in a different plan. They operate under the MAPE contract, and what the governor allotted was a cross-the-board increase of about 1.72%, retirement 0.13%, insurance 0.69%, step increases 1.72%. That's the money that Department of Finance and the governor's office and the Department of Corrections felt that we could live with. Now, I can tell you that the actual number with respect to what it's going to cost us to fund inflation or compensation adjustment for that bargaining unit is going to be somewhere between, over the course of the biennium, between 4.5% and 5%. So it's going to cost us more. And that's why I understand that they are not in corrections early retirement, but nonetheless, their plan gives increases at different intervals. They might be at a particular point in their salary range. We may not have a lot of people at the top of the range where they're not eligible for step increases if they're at the top, as in other plans. So that's what drives the difference. And, you know, I wish I could tell you it's absolutely 4.25 or 4.3, but it's just different, and it's also different for the 2 years. 08 comes in around 5%. 09 comes in at about 4.6%. So those are the real numbers. But again, we fund at about 97-98%. The 4.25 is the number that we support, the number that the Department of Finance, Governor's Office, and Department of Corrections agreed to, and we can live with that. But
okay, thank you. Senator Foley?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Benson, earlier you talked about double bunking and so forth, and what I want to know is, as a result of double bunking and other situations in connection with that, have you had any increase in workers' comp or other injuries sustained by staff members?
Good question.
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, initially when we went to double bunking at Stillwater and St. Cloud, we didn't have a lot of issues at St. Cloud, but we did have issues initially at Stillwater. at St. Cloud, the turnover was pretty quick, so people were not double bunked for a long period of time. The average length of time that they were in a cell, one of those small rooms with two bunks, was somewhere between 30 and 45 days, because that's a reception institution. They move on. So before they get too heated up, they're in orientation all day long, so they're not spending a lot of cell time. But once they go to Stillwater, then, where they're going to be for a while, we found that they were averaging about 6 months in those small rooms, and we had higher unemployment at Stillwater. So we had some pretty serious incidents early on when we started. We had a lieutenant who was pretty seriously assaulted. We had twice as many people that were out on the flag or the bottom area of the cell block. We didn't have enough work. When you bring that many additional bodies into a correctional facility, it's difficult to get the work up. So we ended up backing off. We were up to about 160 double bunked, and we backed that down to about 110. And our employment, our MnCorp program, is doing much better at that facility. So our unemployment rate has dropped. Our unemployment in our agency, or unprogrammed rate, is about 13%. So we haven't had, we certainly have not had systemic violence or unrest, but we've had those isolated incidents.
Commissioner, I think the question was workers' comp injuries and things like that.
Well, certainly we've had several staff get assaulted, and that does result in some loss of work. But again, to my knowledge, nothing that has been prolonged or real serious. We did have somebody who had some cheekbones broken recently, but I believe that was at our high custody institution. It wasn't the result of double bunking.
Other questions on this issue? Representative Hillstrom.
Another issue.
Okay. For the commissioner, or okay. Why don't we do that? Oh, before we take that question, if there's anybody here who is here just because you are interested in the policy working group, they are not going to meet tonight, so you're dismissed. If there's anybody here who's just for that, those discussions. Okay. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In Stateline Midwest, I'm not certain if you're familiar with this article, there's an article that shows that projections are on a steep rise in prison population. And one of the things that I'm very concerned about is that it states that in the Midwest, annual operating costs per prisoner range from a high of $29,260 in Minnesota to a low of $14,157 in South Dakota. I'm interested in your perspective about why Stateline Midwest might consider Minnesota as the high in the Midwest. It also states that Minnesota has a prison population growth between 2006 and projected 2011 of 13% when our general population is only going to grow 4.7%. And one of the factors that this report does single out is that parole violation is a principal factor in the Midwest projected prison population increase. And so I'd like you to kind of respond.
Well, I can, obviously, Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, we have lots of history with this per diem issue, and I'm not familiar with the article from which you got this information. I can tell you that we have had a discussion and division about even between the county jails in terms of how everybody computes their per diem. And some include educational costs, healthcare costs, all costs. Some don't. In some systems, the university hospital provides health care, so that's not a part of their per diem. I can tell you that 11 years ago, our per diem in Minnesota was about $86 a day when I came to central office. And it went down to a low, I believe, of about $76 a day over that 11-year period. and we absorbed somewhere around $18 a day inflation. So I think Minnesota has done a remarkable job of bringing the cost down. And unfortunately, one of the primary drivers of that is we're a bigger system, and we have more offenders to spread it out over. So the budget is obviously much bigger, but the daily cost is lower. Now, the last couple of years, the per diem has started to creep up again. I think it's around $80 a day. But again, compared to 11 years ago, it was $86, $87 a day. And there's an inflationary factor of 2, 3% a year that the department has absorbed. So that when you start looking at per diems, nobody compares apples to apples. There used to be what we referred to as a corrections yearbook, where everybody reported their per diem. Now they have quit publishing that, so it's more scattered. I think the more accurate measure is what do the Minnesota taxpayers pay for their correctional system. And that information is available in Governing Magazine, and I can tell you we're one of the lowest in the nation when you look at how much do Minnesota taxpayers pay for their correctional system. State and local combined, I think we're somewhere around 37. Just at the state level, we're even lower than that. So we have some things in our system that other systems don't. We do a lot of programming. I don't know that there's any system our size that has 1,000 inpatient treatment beds as Minnesota does. We do adequately staff our prison, and I think I'd much rather be having this conversation with you tonight than the one that they're probably having in Indiana, where a prison was burnt significantly yesterday because it probably wasn't properly staffed. I don't know. But when that happens, California, if you've got friends in California, are having systemic problems. And you also get what you pay for. And I think we've worked hard over the years of trying to bring these costs down to a more moderate level that's been more acceptable to policymakers. I know when they were still publishing the yearbook, we went from number one or two to number 11 or 12. So I haven't been in every prison in the nation, but I've been in a lot of them. I can tell you that if one of my sons were locked up, I would hope he'd be locked up in a Minnesota prison. So I think they are safe. I think that we do offer some things that many systems don't, and but that doesn't come without some cost either. So I think the taxpayers in this state get a good bang for their buck.
I have Representative Hillstrom, Representative Smith, and Senator Olson all in a list here, and Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, I actually brought this up as part of the policy discussion, but not all of you are on the policy. I have had significant concern with the fact that we have in-state statute a way that the Department of Corrections is supposed to be reporting per diem, and they don't report it according to state statute. And this report shows Minnesota at a high of $29,260 for Minnesota. But if you actually calculate per diem the way state statute says that you should calculate it, it would be around $98.84 per day at 365 days, which would be $36,077. And so I think that that's something that the House and Senate ought to care about very much. If we're going to have something in state statute about how a per diem is supposed to be calculated, then I think it ought to be calculated that way. And it would make it certainly much easier to compare apples to apples. And if we don't want it to be reported that way, then we should probably repeal it.
Commissioner, and members and people who are going to testify, with the lateness of the hour, possibly we should be brief in comments and answers and see if we can pack a lot of work into a few hours tonight. Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, I recall the discussion we had regarding the reporting of the per diem. The statute requires that we report the per diem that way in our biannual performance report, and I think it was in our biannual performance report. I think where we neglected to include it was in our budget documents. So, and we apologize for that, but it was in the biannual report. With all of the different provisions. I can tell you that nationally, nobody includes debt service. Nationally, there are states that don't include, in some cases, fringe benefit for staff. Nationally, there are systems that don't include education, and nationally, there are systems that don't include health care. So good luck to all of us if we think we're going to get everybody out there to report it apples to apples. And we're all for, I'm all for, if we report it one way every single year, we can look at it, and then I think that's a good measure. But to then put it in the context of what South Dakota is reporting or Iowa, that doesn't work. It starts to fall apart in a real hurry. And the last point I would make is we got so crowded, as you know, and we couldn't keep up with adding additional beds, so we are renting beds. And that's not that cheap, but it does compare. But our per diem is also creeping up because we are adding staff at this point, because we've done lots and lots of bonding, and we haven't added the inmates to those sites. Down at Faribault, we probably added 15, 20 staff, but we haven't added one single inmate. We've got $100 million worth of bonding going on. We have to have lots of correctional staff to make that happen, and we haven't got the offenders there. So that's a high per diem. Same thing is happening at CIP, Challenge Incarceration Program. So per diems go up and down depending on what's happening at those physical plants, too. There's lots and lots that needs to be understood if somebody is going to be critical one way or another of our per diem.
Representative Smith, was your comment on this? Or another
Madam
comment.
Chairman, I think it's on this point, and it's short. Madam Chairman, thank you. Deputy Commissioner Benson, Commissioner Benson, did I hear you say Minnesota's 37th ranked in number of incarcerations per 100,000?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, incarceration rate, I think we're lower than that. I think we're 48th or 49th with respect to incarceration rate. I was talking about the cost of our correctional system per taxpayer.
Madam Chairman, Commissioner Benson, so the lowest in the last 4 years is where we're at now, 48th. Commissioner Benson, were we not at 49th or 50th within the last couple of years or so?
Commissioner?
Yes,
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, you're absolutely correct. It's 48th, 9th, or 50th. We were tied with Maine, number one and two,
Madam
and I
Chair,
think it was
Deputy,
number three.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Benson, so Minnesota is incarcerates the least amount per 100,000. We're ranked at or near the bottom of the rest of the states. The flip side of the coin is folks on probation. Where does Minnesota rank, if you know, compared to the other states?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, I don't know precisely where we rank, but I know that we're very high. We have lots of people on supervision in Minnesota. We reserve our prison beds for those people that we really believe need to be in prison. We try to do a lot at the community level. The three deliveries.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Benson, the last question I have is, Minnesota yet remains at or near the bottom of incarcerations, yet you indicate over the last 10 years it was a doubling, there may be an increase, yet we maintain one of the lowest rankings. But what do you know, or do you have an idea of the factor or factors involved in an increase in incarcerations, if you know?
Commissioner? Madam Chair and Representative Smith, I think there are lots of drivers around that. Certainly the parole violators, that number has gone up in recent years. Drugs, sex offenders are two of the drivers. The percent of drug offenders, I think back in the early 90s, was somewhere around 3 or 4%, up to over 20%. Sex offenders are up around 18% in our system. So those are two of the drivers. Certainly methamphetamine in recent years has been one of the significant drivers. Drug sentencing in Minnesota has been a significant driver of our growth. But you are correct. We still remain at or near the bottom in terms of incarceration rate.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just one more. So, Commissioner Benson, would it be safe to characterize, would it be safe to suggest that if there is an increase in incarcerations in this state, that it's due to what you just said, drugs, and that if and when this legislature ratchets up a level of crime or criminality, that is not necessarily a factor or main factor at all in the rising incarceration rates. Is that the case?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, well, the other driver, of course, are somewhere around 75 to 100 sentencing enhancements. I think sentences have got longer in Minnesota over the course since 1989, and that obviously has been a driver as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to make my questions short and to the point. And I would really appreciate it if you could try to do the same with your answer.
Just following up on what Representative Olson said, and I'm new to the
Senator committee. Olson, your microphone is far away from where
Sorry.
You're talking.
I'm new to this committee, so when you talk about per diem, are you talking about the cost per year to house an average prisoner?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, we're talking about the daily cost.
Okay. And
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When it comes to the daily cost, I'm sure that it's no more difficult to compare insurance costs and those kinds of things between states than it would be for the many other kinds of comparisons we do when we compare employment or college costs or any of those kinds of things. So I just would like to know, and I'm not saying it's a good or bad thing, but is Minnesota spending more per day per prisoner than the surrounding states in the Midwest?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, the document that we used to refer to was called the Corrections Yearbook. That publication has not been published for, I believe, 2 or 3 years. So there has, to my knowledge, there has not been a document. I'm not familiar with the document that Representative Hillstrom speaks to. What is out there is Governing Magazine, which measures differently. They measure your correction system per capita state population, so that's measured a little bit differently.
Senator Olson. Well, Madam Chair, Commissioner, it really surprises me as much money as we spend on corrections that we wouldn't have the answer to that question. Because when you say that we're spending so much per population, and I'm thinking, well, gee, if we're on the bottom 48th in terms of the number of prisoners, but we're 35th or 36th in terms of how much we pay, then that just makes sense that we're paying more than average per prisoner because we're not incarcerating as many people. But again, I guess I feel like we're sort of getting talked around in circles on this very straightforward question, because I'd be really surprised that someone doesn't know the answer to that question.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, well, we're a system of 9,000 people, and I apologize if you think we're talking around this issue. This has been an issue that has been before this agency for the last 15 years. We're very familiar with our per diem. I can tell you precisely what our per diem is, and we're not playing any games with that. But I don't keep up with what Iowa's is, or South Dakota, or North Dakota, or Wisconsin. Now, the other thing that I think we need to understand is, do you want a system like Texas where the per diem, the daily cost, is probably $50 a day, but they have 160,000 people locked up? Or do we want a system where, and I think Minnesota has made good informed decisions about who they reserve these expensive prison beds for. In Minnesota, today it's around $80 a day. That's what it costs. And I can tell you that what happens if we take that cost down to $75 a day. Now, nobody has ever said we want you to do a annual comparison to the five-state area or upper Midwest. What we do look at is comparable wages out there. But what starts to happen in a real hurry is you can't compare apples to apples. For instance, we pay for our own health care. There are systems out there that get free health care through their state university system. So it becomes very, very difficult to compare apples to apples. In Minnesota, we have an agreement with the court that we have to have one psychologist for every 250 offenders. Most states don't have that. So that's a driver that's unique to Minnesota. So there are lots of subtleties that make our costs different in this state.
Well, I didn't realize you were going to open such a hornet's nest here on this issue. One last question, Senator Olson, and then
Madam Chair, I guess I don't want to belabor the point. It was just, my point was only, not that I'm saying that this was good or bad, but just as we're looking at the numbers, it's appreciated to have just a straightforward answer. And that's all I wanted to say.
Senator Neville, one last.
Well, Madam Chair, I just want to ask a few questions on per diem, too.
Okay.
Truly, we have beat the Department of Corrections on this over the last 10 years. And just, Senator Olson, for your information, I mean, I remember how difficult it is to compare state to state. Our prison guards made, once upon a time, $5,000 higher than Wisconsin's did to start. Our health care expenses were $8 a day higher. There's a lot of things that are just different here than other states, but the question that I wanted to ask in particular was a couple more on the Appleton prison. You said we're still leasing beds. Can you tell me how many beds we're leasing and what the per diem is that we're paying for those? And thirdly, are we having any problems with the inmates that are staying there instead of a state facility?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Senator Neville. Today we have about 1,070, 1,080 at Appleton. The per diem out there, what we pay CCA is about $58 a day. In addition to that, there are central office costs that bring that per diem up very close to what we pay, or our per diem at our medium custody institutions. The one cost, so it's right in the area of $70, a little over $70, very comparable to our mediums. They don't have that same health care cost that we got because they have limitations on who they'll take out there. But I have to tell you that I have been impressed with the kind of job they do out there. They haven't had, again, systemic violence or unrest out there. They started a chemical dependency program that is licensed the way that ours are. Years ago, we had serious concerns about Appleton, but it's worked for us as a relief valve in our system. Populations go up or down, so I think there's some value in their presence from that perspective, but it's In terms of cost, it compares comparably.
And then, just a follow-up, do you expect that when Faribault opens, that will end, or do you expect that we'll continue the leasing arrangement with, is that still CCA?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, yes, it is. It is CCA that owns it. There may be a dip at Appleton, but again, based on the projections that other members have alluded to, we're going to need those prison beds if we don't do anything significant with sentencing policy.
So in this budget period, the money that you're asking for the institutional, that still assumes how many beds at Appleton?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, I believe in the second year of the biennium that number dips a bit. I don't have that exact number, but it would not be a sound practice to pull 1,000 inmates out of Appleton and fill up Faribault in a day. That would get the system into lots and lots of trouble. We would open up Faribault very slowly and build that population as new offenders come into the system.
So what's your estimate as to how many will still have an Appleton at the end of this biennium?
Madam Chair,
I'm not asking if, just a best guess.
I'd ask Mr. Storkamp to respond to that. I think it might go down to 700 or 800.
Okay. That's good enough for my purposes. Okay.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Benson, do these figures include the expansion to the Challenge Incarceration Program? or is there an expansion in the SIP program?
Madam Chair, and Senator Rosen, yes, the CIP program, we do have dollars appropriated for that to bring it up to as high as 160. We actually have a
capacity. Is that included in the 4.25 amount?
Madam Chair, yes, it is. The staff that would be staffing that would be subject to that increase.
Okay. All right, let's give the commissioner a break and move to an item that we dealt with differently in the two budgets, and that is the probation caseload reduction grant. Mr. Carger, you folks opened it up to more than the sex offenders that was in the governor's proposal. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes it is.
Okay. Mr. Turner, what did we do? Did we open it up as well?
No.
Okay.
We funded it at a lower level. And actually, you're asking if we opened it up? Yes, we did open it up, but we funded it at a much lower level.
Okay. So, yeah. Representative Paymer.
I think on a spreadsheet, though, Mr. Turner, it was still on the Senate side, was still for sex offender probation caseload reduction. I think so. I'm not sure when we crafted this, it was by intent to basically. You know, we've heard from around the state that counties are frustrated with huge caseloads, so we were trying to address that with a little bit more money and taking off the requirement that caseload reduction be for sex offenders only and giving counties more latitude. But now I don't know.
Sherry Munyon, I believe, was here a minute ago. Is she still here? Ms. Munyon, would you come on up and maybe is it Mr.
Paquet,
just like it's spelled. Okay. You are the Association of County Probation Officers, is that correct?
Yes, Minnesota Association.
Talk to us about this, please.
Okay.
Yes. And again, briefly, please.
My name is Steve Paquet. I'm Court Service Director from Chisago County, Minnesota. I'm also the Legislative Chair for the Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers. I'm going to be addressing the probation caseload reduction portion of the two bills. I'll keep my comments to them as best I can. The Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers prepares the funding approach that the House has proposed in designating a more general caseload reduction rather than restricting funds only to sex offenders. All Minnesota counties are facing increasing caseloads, and we suggest that funds be available for all counties to meet their individual needs, whether adult or juvenile, and whether they're felony, gross, or misdemeanor offenses. However, we do recommend amending the House language. Our concern is that the Probation Caseload Reduction Grant Program, which began in 1996 as a result of the 1994 Probation Standards Report, was designed to fairly distribute new probation service funding across Minnesota's three corrections delivery systems, the county probation officer counties, the Department of Corrections contract counties, and the Community Corrections Act counties, with the goal of addressing locally identified needs. This funding program, although reduced and closed in 2003, developed a successful history of providing corrections programs specific to the needs of each of the 87 counties. As a result of the increased funding, probation caseloads were reduced and specialized supervision programs such as intensive supervision programs for drunk drivers, domestic assault specific caseloads, group supervision, sex offender specific caseloads, as well as computerized probation caseload tracking programs and prevention and diversion programs were initiated. The Probation Caseload Reduction Grant Funds did not designate specific categories or groups of offenders. Our issue is that by changing the existing probation caseload reduction grant program into a categorical aid program, by restricting the new probation supervision funding to only adult felony and juvenile offenders, or to only adult or juvenile sex offenders, the option of addressing locally defined corrections needs is removed. In addition, these funding approaches effectively eliminate the 55 CPO and DOC contract counties from accessing any of this new probation funding for their hundreds of non-felony adult cases and non-sex offender juvenile cases. This is not the original purpose of the program. Maxwell urges you to remove the felony and juvenile designations from the House language and distribute the funds through caseload reduction as has been done for the last 11 years. This action will permit the new probation supervision funds to be fairly distributed to all 87 counties to be used to address the corrections needs as determined by each individual county. Removing the restrictive language would allow counties to increase supervision of felony offenses and increase supervision of gross misdemeanor repeat DWI cases, misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor domestic assault cases, felony cases which are reduced to gross misdemeanors at time of sentencing, as well as misdemeanor and juvenile cases. Accessing this new funding is even more important for our counties, as the most recent county probation officer reimbursement check from the state was 38% of our request instead of 50%. That's the lowest since 1975. I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Pequay, would you assume that the increased funds that we would put toward this would be for hiring new probation officers, or is it for salary increases, or how does this work? It's my first year on this committee, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, the Probation Caseload Reduction Fund basically took a pot of money, divided it using the Community Corrections Act formula, which was the fairest one we could come up with, and distributed it to all the counties. The restrictions for the use were pretty broad. Basically, it was to reduce probation caseloads. That's what the study that prompted the whole thing was showing, that we had way too many cases per probation officer. So the majority of the money went to hiring new probation officers. Then once you hire the new probation officers, if you can get the caseloads down, then you can start looking at specialized probation programs for specific kinds of offenses, like the domestic abuse cases. I think Hennepin County put together a domestic abuse-specific program, and they did a follow-up study that came out very well. We've done that in our county as well. Intensive supervision for juvenile offenders, DWI offenders, if that's what the need of the county is. And that's really the key, is we base it on what's the need for the individual counties. That's the key, and that's what gets the, you know, all the agencies pulling together.
Okay, thank you. I assume there are people who have a difference of opinion on this, and if they'd like to come up to the table, while Representative Paymar asks his question.
I'll wait.
Madam Chair?
Senator Neville.
Just a quick question. We're talking about the lines 229 and 230?
Yes.
Is one of our fiscal people, is all of that money, that all goes to the counties? This isn't money that stays for the DOC provision, is it? Or is it across the board provision for that?
Mr. Carter?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I believe it is across the board.
It is across the board?
Okay. And Mr. Nelson from Corrections, Deputy Commissioner Nelson can correct me if I'm wrong.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, the purpose in the governor's budget for this money was to lower sex offender caseloads, and if not sex offender caseloads, at least high predatory, high risk, dangerous offenders. So the original intent of this money was to not be under the old caseload workload reduction, which did go to all three systems. This money was intended, if you remember 2005, you had the legislative auditor's report on the supervision of sex offenders, and they were quite concerned because the sex offender caseloads were quite high, and the enhanced sex offender caseloads, they're pushing 1 to 50, and they still are. Hennepin County's, they just told me that their enhanced sex offender caseloads are close to 1 to 50. It was determined in that legislative auditor's report and with other studies that if you want to do the supervision of sex offenders, 1 to 35 is ideal. So this money was put in there partially as a result of that legislative auditor's report of 2005 to try to reduce those sex offenders, and we're talking about felony sex offenders, whether they be adults or juveniles. So the intent of the governor's budget was to put that out into the CCA counties, and the other 55 counties would also get it, where the state does that service, to try to reduce those enhanced sex offender caseloads, getting them down closer to the 1 to 35. The legislative auditor's report was very concerned about the number of visits of those sex offenders when the caseloads are that high. I have no I'm not against caseload workload reduction, which I think the last time was about 5 years ago, and that did go across all three systems and was there to reduce even the misdemeanor and the gross misdemeanor caseloads also. But that was not the purpose or the intent of the governor's budget. 10% of the governor's budget did go out to fund juvenile sex offenders, because when the enhanced sex offender caseload money came prior to that, it was just looking at adult felons, and with the idea and the knowledge that you have some dangerous juvenile sex offenders also, that's what the purpose of the money is for. If you were to spread this out of caseload workload reduction, you would be diluting the effect on those sex offender or high predatory offender caseloads to some degree.
Questions? I guess Representative Paymar, I have a question. I apologize, I haven't looked at your new language, but is your funding to go out to all 87 counties across the three systems?
Madam Chair, that's what I understood. That was our intent. I guess this committee should really decide on where the greatest need is, and I'm not saying that we don't have a need of reducing the caseload for probation officers who are handling sex offenders. But there's also another huge need out there, and I don't see that in the governor's budget, so maybe we need to have more discussion on how to do that.
Yes.
Commissioner Nelson?
Yeah. I'm sure, Senator Payer, there is other dollars in the governor's budget that will help in those areas. There is money for the CPO reimbursement to increase that to some degree. And when those dollars get closer to $50, when they get closer to 50%, those counties then and the county boards are more apt to allow hiring of additional probation officers. Those are on lines 226, this Community Corrections Act increase, which goes to the Community Corrections Act counties. There's a CPO increase, which goes towards the CPO reimbursement. And on line 228, there's DOC services, which goes towards the Department of Corrections agents in those 55 counties. Also, it's wrong to say that it's not going to all 87 counties. In the 55 counties where the felony supervision is provided by the Department of Corrections, those counties would be receiving it for the higher risk sex offenders, the higher risk predatory offenders. So all of the money would be going to all 87 counties. Where it wouldn't be going, when it's there for sex offenders, it would not be going for misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors, of which there are very few sex offenders. It's not that there's not any, but those are not the ones. Those are the ones that are more nuisance than scary. They're the ones that are less dangerous, less apt to do something, a forcible type of rape. They're probably a misdemeanor exposer who exposed himself to other adults. So there are a few misdemeanor sex offenders, but very few, and they're not the ones that we're scared of.
So, Madam Chair, Commissioner, so you would prefer that we leave the governor's language in there? The department would prefer that.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, yes. But that was the governor's budget, and that's the budget that I have to support, and the intent there was to get those sex offender caseloads done. Mm-hmm.
Other questions? Mr. McQuaid.
Madam Chair, I understand Harley's comments. My only concern is that by leaving the phrase adult felon offender, it eliminates funding from going to any of the gross misdemeanor cases that we've talked about. Some are equally dangerous in a different way. Multiple repeat drunk drivers scare me to death. Gross misdemeanor domestic assault people are nasty people. Those are the kinds of people that we're not going to be able to use these funds to address, in addition to first-time misdemeanor assault people, as well as juveniles and everything else. So our concern is that it's limiting it to a by using that phrase, it limits the access of the money to a smaller group, and it's not going to be able to address some of the local needs that some of these other counties have.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering if there's anyone from the CCA counties that would...
That would be a good input to get to. For anybody here from the CCA counties?
CCA.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Pequeno.
Yeah.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Terry Spiker, and I actually represent Ramsey County. So I am a member. Our county is a member of the Community Corrections Act counties, and we do not have one of our overall lobbyists here with us tonight. Mary Beth Davidson is also here from Hennepin County. So between Hennepin and Ramsey, we represent probably the counties with the highest number of felon sex offenders in them. And as I talk with Mary Beth, part of what we are concerned about is, and would prefer, I guess, to be able to continue to direct this money towards felons, we are concerned about reducing that amount of funds. So I would like to be able to respond to you better, but I feel like I should say this on behalf of the pressure in our county.
Questions for Ms. Spiker. Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, Ms. Spiker, what is your caseload per agent now, and how much would it be reduced if the governor's recommendation of funding was provided?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, that's the piece that I can't answer for you, but I would get that back to you. The head of our corrections department is not here, but I would like to be able to give the committee members that information.
That would also vary by county to county, I'm sure.
It would.
Yeah.
Ms. Davidson, do you happen to know what Hennepin County's is?
Mary Beth Davidson, Hennepin County. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I do not, and Ron Weiberg is out of town tonight.
Okay. If you two will get that information back to us, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you
very much. Okay. So that's another puzzle we're going to have to try to figure out, members. Let's see. Do we want to talk about reentry for a while? Or is there another subject here in corrections that anybody else would be interested in? We have a lot of various reentry proposals that have been presented both to the House and the Senate, and the House preferred some and the Senate preferred others, and sometimes we agreed in the middle on some. And they're very different proposals. Some are jobs only. We have one proposal that's a big wraparound of all kinds of services at the community level. In the Senate, we don't know anything about the productive day program that didn't get heard in our body at all. So I don't know if those folks are here, but maybe Representative Gamer, if you could give us a little, just a little information on how that one differs from others.
Madam Chair, Mr. Carter, maybe you can help me out on this also. This is Productive Day was a reentry program that was housed at the Arrowhead Regional Corrections, which is Duluth, St. Louis County, and was dropped during the budget cut years, I believe, that instead of focusing all of our reentry efforts into the metropolitan area, we thought it was important to have some reentry efforts in greater Minnesota.
I agree.
And so that's the other reentry efforts here are the continuation of the one in Olmsted County. And
which one is that called?
That is on line 236, I think.
Okay.
Where's the Olmsted County? Yeah, that's Olmsted County, yes. This was the This was the pilot project that was originally was to be Olmsted Ramsey in Hennepin County, and as I as maybe some of the DOC wants to respond to this, but apparently money just didn't go anywhere. Not too much progress was made, and if indeed the conference committee wants to accept the metro demonstration project, which is a 5-year project, primarily in Hennepin Ramsey County, I believe, then our purpose here was to continue the efforts in Olmsted County.
Okay. The part of the 5-year demonstration project that could be problematic is that neither of us have any tails on the project. So we both funded it with one-time money. So that's probably another loose end that we should look at. You were able to put more money toward that than the Senate was.
Madam Chair, I think
is anybody here from that program? Is Mr. Thomas here? I have a question for you, if you could, please. Welcome. Thanks for coming on over in the dead of the night.
You're welcome.
Is the network going to be strictly for former offenders, or do you envision a time in which you expand to at-risk folks who may not be actual offenders?
Madam Chair, the legislation as written in the House would any state funding would be for people released from custody from state corrections. But the broader network, which I represent as the Chief Executive Officer, would serve a range of at-risk adults. Those leaving other institutional settings like a county workhouse, drug treatment program, a hospital setting. But the state funding, at least on the House side in this case, would be solely used for men or adults released from state correctional facilities.
Okay. I have one more question. Representative Paymar, while I think of my other question.
We were just, we've had some debate here the last couple of days about a line item that we have in the House on bed impact savings based on the premise that we were going to expand drug courts and also significantly expand the reentry efforts for the Department of Corrections. So I don't know if you can speak to your assumptions about what you think might happen and how, and projections that you might have about recidivism reduction based on your intervention.
Sure. Representative Paymar, we haven't projected a specific reduction in recidivism that will occur as a result of our efforts, although, as described in the legislation, we want to be held accountable for reducing recidivism. So that's why this legislation is written that we would receive a fixed rate payment, and some of the payment would be tied to us meeting certain outcomes, such as no arrest or reduced arrest, reduced probation violations, increased earned income, and increased child support payments. We are building our model on evidence and good models from around the country. For instance, there's lots of evidence that housing with services in at least 3 studies has led to reduced arrest and jail use time. There's evidence that if you provide stable housing with work, there's a lower likelihood that someone will be reincarcerated or abscond. We are also modeling one aspect of our work on a program in Portland, Oregon, where they're taking the highest risk offenders coming out on parole from state prison. And they have found, now it's not a longitudinal study, but their initial indicators are that after the first 9 months that only about 25% of their population is either being rearrested or going back to prison. That's a dramatic reduction in terms of what their state standard is, around 60 or 50% recidivism. So we aren't guaranteeing a reduced we're confident we're going to reduce recidivism rates. We're not saying what that is going to be yet, and that's why we've couched this as a 5-year demonstration. Is that helpful?
It is, but I'm just wondering, based on the states that you're modeling this after, I mean, can't you say with any more?
Well, I know in the area of arrest, Matt and Chair, in the area of arrest, there's routinely a reduction of 50 to 40% reduction in arrest rates. And obviously, the arrest is leading to being reincarcerated. So we have, we're confident that we're going to have an impact on arrest rates. And if you wanted a range, I would say it's in the range of that 40 to 50% range.
All right. Mr.
And Mr. Thomas, Madam Chair, I'm just refreshed by memory here on the measuring to know that there'll be an ongoing evaluation. Are we going to have annual reports back if you are a lot of this money through the DOC about your success? Or?
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, yes, there's annual reports that would be required, and that would be performance and quantitative information. The actual evaluation, though, some of those results may take several years to assemble because you want to track a comparison group and you want to track the people enrolled. But yes, there are annual performance reports.
Thank you.
Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry I didn't get your name.
Mr. Thomas.
Steve Thomas.
When you're looking at the reentry or those offenders and you're talking about your role in getting them law-abiding, what kinds of people are you getting? Are you looking at people that are reoffending, or is this somebody that's a probation violator?
Mr. Thomas.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, in the case of with the state funding, it would be adults being released from a state correctional facility, and I don't know, but I would say it would be very likely that they would be on probation upon release. I mean, that's often the case. So with this state funding, that's the adult population. Typically, at-risk means these are going to be adults who not only are being released from custody of corrections, but they have history of substance abuse, high rates of histories of substance abuse, high rates of mental illness, often both mental illness and substance abuse, poor employment records, poorly educated. That's where we look at recidivism. That it's not necessarily just a corrections issue or a criminal justice issue. There's a range of social, mental health, and economic issues going on here that we intend to address.
Madam Chair, looking at that, that's been one real problem, though, is that we haven't recognized that many of those folks have two or three different problems. They got drug problems, and they're mentally ill, and so forth. And how are we dealing with that population? I know that the prison system itself has been improving while I've been looking at it, but I still think that that's a serious problem. What's your assessment of what the corrections department is doing in that area?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Tom?
Senator Foley, following up on what Deputy Commissioner Benson was saying earlier, I think Minnesota is one of the much better correction systems when it comes to dealing with substance abuse, mental health issues. I don't think, though, that's the best setting for those issues to be dealt with over the long term. I mean, these issues should be dealt with in the community. That's where the bulk of the services are. Corrections' job is to protect the public and care for folks while they're in their care and custody, but almost all of them come back out to the community. And this demonstration and the model we're proposing is one of the few in the nation that we're aware of that is intentionally dealing with these myriad of issues at the same time. The systems right now are highly fragmented. If you have a mental health issue, you go to the mental health system. But if you've got a substance abuse issue, you go to the substance abuse system. Neither one of those systems, their primary issue is not work, and yet you got to work. Mm-hmm. So we're this demonstration and our models intended to have five core features in play at once: stable housing, a job, behavioral health care, access to primary health care, and re-engagement with your family and community. And right now, those things are scattered in a variety of different venues in the community. And our premise is, and we're confident that we'll prove this, is that if you make those all available at once and you provide them in a quality manner, you will have a real impact on recidivism rates.
Senator Rosen?
Madam Chair, my question was answered.
Okay. Senator Foley, did you have another question?
Madam Chair, yes. What I'm concerned about is collateral consequences that we often don't think about until it's too late. What's your thoughts on that?
Senator Foley, that is a huge hurdle for this population as they reenter the community. And the two biggest ones are the ones we're dealing with first. That's housing and work. Many landlords will not take adults with felony records. Not only that, their lifestyle has usually led to broken leases, not paying rent. So it's not an attractive population to rent housing to. So they end up usually in poor housing, poorly managed housing. So we're dealing with the housing issue. And then there's the work issue. There's many employers that, at least on first blush, won't hire somebody with a felony record. So we are intentionally trying to both through job creation and through relationships with certain employment sectors, trying to aggressively deal with the employment issue. Because without that housing and without that work, the rest of the stuff just can't get any traction. It's very hard to encourage someone to go to drug aftercare treatment when they're worrying about where their next paycheck is going to come from or where they're going to live.
One last thing, Madam Chair. One of the things that has occurred, and I want to know what the results are, is that lack of work that we're providing in many of those situations, or lack of training, that we've mandated that the pay for itself, and that may sound good, but in the end, it seems to me that that's not practical. It's a safety factor for the for not only the staff but for the inmates, and I think in that area that we really need some work.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, I'm not as fully aware with MnCorp, but I think those in the institutional job programs can be a launching pad, and it's a good prep for when the adults do reenter the community. It's starting to build some of the habits and, in some cases, the skills that are needed when you're out in the community. But again, that we think the power of this network is that even if you have those skills or that experience, it's a tough employment market if you've got a felony record, and that's what we intend to try to tackle.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Thomas, very much.
Thank you.
Members, another area where we differed is the mentoring grants for kids whose parents are incarcerated. And I believe Ms. Sandvig is here. I'm not sure who else is here to talk about that. But maybe we could have just a couple of minutes conversation about the differences in the two proposals, House and Senate. Because I think the Senate one expanded on the original proposal. Ms. Sandvig.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, my name is Linda Sandvig. I'm here with Big Brothers. I also have Patty Hag here, who is Vice President of Programs with Big Brothers Big Sisters, to give you more specific information. But generally, the proposal that we came with this session was built on a federal grant that Big Brothers Big Sisters received in 2003 in looking at this special population. We got a one-time grant last year in the bill, and then this year we're looking to continue on. The original proposal was for $250 to continue that proposal. When that in the Senate side, there was interest, particularly in St. Paul with the Parks and Recs programs and things like that. We found that we were finding kind of the same kids that they were finding in the Parks and Recs, in particular zip codes in those cities. So we looked at, could we expand the program and do better collaboration with getting kids that are at high risk in high crime neighborhoods. And so we looked at putting additional money into that to expand on the program that we had. Also, reaching kids with similar types of backgrounds that we could do more in working in their neighborhood communities and expanding that.
Representative Paymer.
Chair, Ms. Sandvik, do you have, besides this appropriation, do you have, does Big Brothers, Big Sisters have money in any other legislative bills this session?
Mr. Chair, no, we do not.
Questions on this proposal?
Madam Chair.
I'm going to do it again. Representative Hillstrom.
That's okay. Madam Chair, my concern with the Senate proposal was that it specifically stated Minneapolis and St. Paul, and I believe that the program typically serves people in other areas. For example, the testifier has a brother or sister in my community. And so when you specifically name Minneapolis and St. Paul working with the Parks Department, I have some concern that that may preclude others from participating in the event that someone has someone from another community.
Representative Hillstrom, Ms. Andrew.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, the proposal when we deal with the Big Brothers Big Sisters covers seven county metro area, so it would include Brooklyn Center and that in the original proposal as far as incarcerated. Some of the expansion was looking at high crime neighborhoods in Minneapolis and St. Paul. However, the proposal is broader than just those two cities. We also have programs, affiliates in St. Cloud area and Owatonna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I might suggest that maybe you would encourage them working with the Parks and Rec Department of whichever community they happen to be in rather than specifically maybe any other
city. Senator Olson?
And Madam Chair, I guess I would just make a pitch as well for even way up in northern Minnesota, we have Boys and Girls Clubs that perform a very valuable service to youth. They're relatively new clubs, but a high percentage, at least by population, of children in our area are growing up with parents who are incarcerated as well. And I think the money would have value in any Boys and Girls Club around the state for that purpose.
And members, the House has one-time money and the Senate has ongoing money. So we can, having the ongoing money gives us an opportunity to not just have a small project in a couple of areas, but be able to work in many places. I think Big Brothers and Big Sisters is a wonderful organization. I'm glad that they came to the legislature to propose this for our consideration. Any other questions for them?
Madam Chair, in the last 10 years I was involved in both Health and Human Services and the crime prevention and so forth, and there's money being expended in the Health and Human Services on group housing and some other institutions that perhaps we should be aware of. Looking for funding programs.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch.
What I'm saying.
Is that related to the Big Brothers and Big Sisters program?
It's not that specific organization, but it's others similar to that go through the mentoring part of it at least.
Okay. All right. Oh, I got it. All right. Always good to remember that. You're exactly right. Any other questions? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Unless anybody has any other issues that they would like to talk about with corrections right now, why don't we move to the votes board?
somebody here from the Coast Guard?
Sure there is.
On your spreadsheet, members, the Coast Guard is 176. We had some differences in the funding and what the items are for. And Mr. Turner, why don't you talk us through what the differences are?
Okay.
Just a quick reminder.
Madam Chair, members, on the Coast Guard, what we have, and I'm just going to talk about what's funded over the base. The governor has $69,000 that he's recommended in increased funding. The House has $119,000 in increased funding. And the Senate has $761,000 in increased funding. Now, the majority of that, we agree that the governor, the Senate, and the House agree on operating cost increases and the compensation adjustments. The difference is the Senate provides law enforcement training reimbursements of $658,000. That's the big difference.
And then of that amount, the domestic abuse training that is called out on line 180 in the House bill, that requirement is included in our larger amount.
Madam Chair, members, that's correct. In the Senate rider, we say they can use up to $50,000 to perform that function.
Representative Paymar? Okay, Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering in the Senate, in the law enforcement training reimbursements, is that just open to them, or is there, in other words, there was one thing we talked about that I was very interested in, that was diversity training for law enforcement. Is yours just open-ended, or is there nothing targeted?
Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, this is an increase in the general law enforcement reimbursements. The Post Board statutorily gets
up to 20.
Yeah, right. But they only get what we appropriate. They're supposed to get more than what we're appropriating. This was the Senate's attempt to bring the Post Board up to at least approaching what the statutory attempt was. And it's not connected to anything. It's just straight reimbursement.
Madam Chair, how much chance would there be of using some of this money for diversity training, or would there be a
Mr. Melton
that you could commit to that, or what likelihood is there of that?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Melton.
For the record, my name is Neil Melton. I am the executive director of the Post Board. The Post Board is all about training, and as part of that, We have heard from chiefs and sheriffs across the state and all 471 agencies that they like a little bit of discretion as to what they're going to spend that money for, because needs vary from across the state. But training is valuable. We support all types of training. If there is a need or an emphasis placed upon law enforcement by the legislature, by the Post Board, we would certainly do that training. And that training, by the way, is already going on across the state. In diversity. We've had this discussion on the courses being offered.
Senator Rosen.
Malton.
Senator Rosen, I can't hear you.
Oh, that's
right. On that note, as far as the training, are you saying that this is not really earmarked towards any certain kind of training for the law enforcement? It's just open to the needs of the sheriffs and the chiefs at the
Mr. Melton.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, Yes, the money that Post receives. There are two training mandates for law enforcement in Minnesota. Number one is annual use of force training that includes everything from empty hand to firearms. And the second is the pursuit driving component every three-year licensing cycle. Other than that, the chiefs and sheriffs and state agency directors, state patrol, colonel, has the discretion to use that money for whatever training needs they deem appropriate.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is just perhaps for the future. I'm not sure if this money could be earmarked towards something like this, but I know the governor is interested in starting a DEC program, a Drug Endangered Children program. And there is a national Drug Endangered Children program. And the sheriffs and the police chiefs are very interested in learning how to handle children that come out of a home that they've been either in a meth home or they've been abused by a parent that's been on some kind of drug. There is training that is needed to handle these children a little bit differently and provide a safe, warm rescue for them. So that's where I'm interested in seeing if there is some flexibility in this training reimbursement or if this is something that could be used in the future once this initiative gets up and going, because I know the governor is very interested in doing it. Chuck Nuremberg is going to be the state DEC coordinator.
Senator Rosen, is that an existing curriculum, or is that something that needs to be developed?
Madam Chair, I actually had the DEC legislation, and the governor did it by executive order this summer, and at a big press conference, and it's been somewhat stale for a while, and now that Chuck Nuremberg is on board, he's also the meth coordinator, drug czar, whatever you'd like to call him, he's also now been in charge of this DEC program. So it is a need that's coming down the pipeline for these police officers to understand how to handle the children.
Mr. Melton, has Mr. Nuremberg talked to you about the Post Board doing the training for that?
Madam Chair, he has not. But if I can make a point, the Post Board doesn't provide training. We approve training. If we were given a directive, as we did in 2001 and 2002 for racial profiling training, we went out with an RFP and got a vendor to provide the training, and we would do the same if we were approached about this initiative.
Representative Mullen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I hate to belabor it, but it is an issue that a lot of people from our district tell me is extremely needed in the suburbs. Minneapolis has had the training, but they tell me when they go to the suburbs, there is a desperate need for some diversity training of law enforcement, and maybe neither side wants to do it, but if we did direct something to it, what chance would there be of making sure that it got done? In other words, somebody, and I think he was from the chiefs of police, said, well, or maybe from the sheriff, said, well, we do what we want, and we may not put in the match if we don't like what the money's for or something. If that did happen, what would be the probability of getting diversity training with that money?
Mr. Melton?
Madam Chair and Representative Mulvey, that training is going on now. I remember bringing the reports to, I believe it was Representative Paymar's committee, perhaps it was yours, on the current training being offered in service right now. And there's a number of vendors, a number of programs. So it's going on. To guarantee it, of course, we take a mandate. I don't know if I can editorialize for a minute, but I talk to chiefs and sheriffs and line officers every day, all day. This topic is on their agenda. It's on their roll call notes at night. It is a topic of conversation at every police gathering I have been to in the 8.5 years I've been at Post. It's not being ignored. It may not be addressed to the level some people would like, but I assure you it is being talked about. And if training is deficient in a certain community, for whatever reason, and maybe it's brought forth by members of the community to the city council, the county board, chiefs and sheriffs are taking action, sending officers to train.
That's it? Okay. Any other questions for the Post Board? Thank you very much, Mr. Melton. Let's see, how about the Sentencing Guidelines Commission? Judge Bowman, there you are.
I knew you had a red jacket on, but we're right behind Mr. Melton, and I couldn't see it.
Taking a target.
Let's see. Where are you? The Sentencing Guidelines Commission is on the top of the paper.
It's the side-by-side, Madam Chair. It's R34, and on the spreadsheet it is line 264 was where it begins.
Thank you. And that's Article A.
Yes, Article 1.
Article 1. Tired. Okay. And Mr. Carter, why don't you tell us what the differences are in these suits? So I don't have to think about it.
Madam Chair, members, there is the difference in the compensation adjustment, of course, and that's throughout the spreadsheet. And then the Senate has an extra $100,000 in there for sealing records and collateral consequences study. And the House has a study, too, where they are supposed to evaluate the effectiveness of reentry programs and drug courts. This is a study that the House is asking the Sentencing Guidelines to do with a report by February 2009. Basically, those are the differences. And the other one is that there's changes to the grid for controlled substance offenses. This is a Senate provision where they're supposed to propose changes to the Sentencing Guidelines grid for controlled substance offenses. They're supposed to look at other states when they're doing this, and there's also a report there in 2008. That's on page R35.
Sorry. Members, we have about, half a dozen studies of some sort or another between the House and the Senate proposals, and at some point we probably should just talk about all of those at one time. I guess probably the first question we should ask is the amount of funding that we have put in the Senate bill adequate to do all of these studies?
Madam Chair and members, yes, it would be. First of all, since we're talking about money, I want to... I want to express the Commission's appreciation for the fact that the legislature has recognized the reasonableness of our base budget request. We are very grateful for that. As to the remaining, this extra $100,000, we also appreciate that the Senate recognized that if the Commission work and staff were to be asked to go outside of our park, if you will, where we're not using our data, we're not, there were functions in that collateral sanctions project that are not things we customarily do. We appreciate that the Senate recognized that we should get some additional funds to be able to pull that off. If the legislature were to mandate that the commission do the re-ranking that was suggested as a possibility if the legislature wanted it by our drug report, we could certainly do that within our base budgets because that's what we do. And it's part of the work that is expected under our statutory mandate. The evaluation of recidivism study we could also accomplish within that $100,000. I do want to express the same misgivings that I heard Sue DeSalle from the state courts express concerning measuring recidivism within an 18-month time frame. We need to recognize that the programs that the commission will be asked to evaluate do not at present exist. So programs, if they are funded, would have to be set up and then candidates would be admitted, and then they would have to finish, and then they would have to have a little time potentially to get into trouble. And probably that's going to probably just getting the program rolling, getting people in and people out, would take most of that 18 months. There is, you know, there's been this continuing discussion here about the impact on recidivism that these programs would have. I think that the proponents of the programs, I look at this network project that you just heard about and the state courts project. Those folks who are setting up these programs are certainly taking into account research that has been done in other places indicating that this kind of approach should have an impact on recidivism. And I know that the committee is concerned not to be funding things that aren't going to have an impact. So the first thing I would say is I don't believe there's reason to fear that these programs will have no impact. That could happen, I guess. Rather, we have a difficult, they probably would not show bed impact within the biennium because, as I said, you know, people have to get in, get out, have time to get rearrested, and so that impact would not show up immediately, probably. And in addition, I think we need to go back to, or I want to go back to a comment I know I made to both House and Senate committees earlier in the year. We want to do the kind of evidence-based practice that the network is talking about because it is based on research and is informed by that research. The fact is, though, that in this day and age, we haven't done all kinds of research that needs to be done. And so it makes sense still to fund programs without knowing immediately at this moment what the impact on recidivism will be, as long as the legislature has done, and the House did, I think, in every single one of its reentry proposals, as long as folks doing those programs are required to do assessment and measurement and prove the impact that they're having. So I think we need to understand there's research already done that informs our work. There's research that needs to be done so that we can develop new programs in the future.
Splendid Paymar.
How many years would you require before you inspect the measurement?
Representative Paymar members, I normally you want a minimum of 12 months after exiting the program. And the recidivism studies I have seen usually start at within a 12-month framework, a two-year framework, a three-year framework. I have seen some also that start with a six-month framework, 12-month framework, whatever. So something like time to get the program rolling, get people in and out, plus 12 months.
Let's go back. So this would be both for reentry as well as for the drug courts or just reentry?
Representative Paymar members, I think as to the drug courts, my understanding is that there are some presently working. So they ought to be able to begin to show results. I can't remember what Ms. DeSalle said, but something maybe a year from now or something, because they are starting to get graduates. Then the new drug courts, of course, would have the same rollout issue.
Madam Chair, what the drug courts, wouldn't we know the results right away because the people that would be diverted would not be going to jail or to prison?
Representative Paymar and members, one of the difficulties, the commission was asked to try to do a bed impact related to drug courts or maybe reentry. One of the problems that I have in answering that question is that I don't know what the criteria are for entry. There are many drug courts. I know Hennepin's, for example, does specifically focus on people who would otherwise be going to prison, because if they don't do that, the savings might not be as great or something. So I, not knowing what the, you know, I think you can have a variety of entry designs, if you will. You could take, previously Hennepin took primarily offenders who, if they were not successful graduates of the drug court, would be going to prison. I know that Ramsey County took a different approach and took many more lower level folks.
Thank you.
Any other questions? You've really given us good, valuable information tonight. Thank you so much.
Just closing, Madam Chair, I think one of the concerns I have, I noticed that in the mentoring programs and some other things, that it's difficult to quantify something that's not going to happen. So if you're doing something and that intervention, there's no clear way of measuring those things. And so I know that the judge said that some of those things lack longitudinal studies, for instance, and we really need that before we can make intelligent decisions.
I think in the mentoring program, especially the program for the children with kids whose parents are incarcerated, when we went down to visit the Red Wing facility, we found out that 67% of the kids down there had a parent in the system. And you know, there may actually be a way to get some longitudinal information through a mentoring program like that as it goes along. But I think you're right. I think it's a longer-term thing. Senator Neville.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Gomez.
You need the microphone, sir.
I probably should know the answer to this, but who keeps the recidivism data? Is it the sentencing guidelines?
No. Senator Neville, members, Corrections does quite a bit of that. I know that DOC did a recidivism study this year. We have usually stopped at the prison door to do that. We have a race project that would have a broader scope than that.
Thanks.
Manager? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Manager. And Judge Gomez, I understand from Senator Neville that other states do not have a sentencing guideline commission. Is that correct? And if they don't, or something, do they have something comparable so you can compare notes, you can compare per diem per day?
Senator Rosen and members, the states have a wide variety of approaches to data gathering, gathering data regarding punishment, and also a wide variety of philosophies about how sanctions should be carried out. We are, in terms of our drug laws, which might be the conversation that you and Senator Neville have, the states immediately surrounding us do not have a structure comparable to the guidelines. So when we do the comparisons, which we can do, what we do in those cases is to look at the most serious offense. You know, how is that defined in Iowa? How is that defined in Wisconsin? What is the price tag in those jurisdictions? And then conversely, we know that our highest or most serious offense has a certain threshold, then we look at if somebody in Iowa had that same amount, what would the punishment be, et cetera. So there are ways to make comparisons that are credible.
Thank you. Any other questions?
thank you very much for spending part of your evening with us.
She spent
all of your evening with us.
All day.
Hang around. Is Mr. Kirkpatrick from the Department of Human Rights here or something? Yes, there you are. Hello. And members, the Department of Human Rights is on R25 of Article 1 and 191 on the spreadsheet. A little bit of difference here, and it might mostly be,
Compensation
adjustment. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have the information system, I think, is the same on both of both the House and the Senate. But the House has a couple of more items that the Senate doesn't have. One is asking the department to conduct a survey on complaints in the Mr. Carter, what is this? This particular one. It's the satisfaction survey. Okay. Yeah. Representative Kamen.
This is what we've asked the Human Rights Department to do when they came before the committee was to, much like the, I'm not sure what they're called now, but the Ombudsman for Crime Victims, they have a new name.
This is the other one.
No, I know, but much they conducted a sort of a consumer survey to find out satisfied or dissatisfied people were using that service. So we were
at the Department of Human Rights?
No. I was trying to make the analogy there, but
I'm sorry.
We were trying to suggest to the Human Rights Department that for a relatively small amount of money that they could conduct a survey of people who have called the or notified the Department of Human Rights violations to determine whether they felt that the cases were handled in a satisfactory manner. So that's basically what this language is. At the time, that's been extremely problematic. I don't know if anything's changed since then.
Mr. Kirkpatrick, is this something that the Department can do for us?
James Kirkpatrick, Deputy Commissioner. We are prepared to do it. We, once we learned of the potential tasking, we went and investigated or tried to find out if there were other agencies that that had the same tasking. We found out that the administrative hearings judges have a same situation, and they have theirs conducted by the Management and Analysis Division. It is a fairly stiff cost. It is our understanding from the Management Analysis Division, it will cost the department about $15,000 to conduct the survey, but it can be done.
How much was to Representative Kamar did you guys allocate for?
Madam Chairman, I'm sure that we have that in it.
Zero. Okay. Any questions on this piece? Then the other working group that the House proposes that be done through the Department of Human Rights is studying inmate complaints, and there's a whole long list of people who would be in this working group. And Commissioner Kirkpatrick, are you familiar with this language?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
Talk to us about whether this is a good fit for your department to do, and whether you have the staffing and various things like that, please.
Madam Chair, again, we're prepared to move forward on that should it remain. It appears that it's a little different from what we're used to doing, but as I said, we're prepared to move forward.
Okay. Representative Paymar, is this, I know that Representative Walker had originally a bill to reinstate the ombudsman function, and this is what we have done.
This is what, Madam Chair, this is what's left of the bill.
Okay. All right. Do you have a sense of what this could you do this within your existing budget, Commissioner, as well as the other study?
The other study would be, is the problematic one. I believe so, ma'am.
Okay.
Madam Chair. We had just suggested, we met with the Commissioner Corbell about this issue early on, and we were just expecting them to convene the initial meetings, and from there the task force or the working group could decide how it wanted to function. So we weren't expecting that to take a huge amount of time on the department's part, but they did express a willingness to want to participate in it because they get a lot of complaints also from inmates and families about these issues.
So, Representative Paymar, the department would not be staffing this working group? Or they could, but maybe not? Is that how it would be?
Yeah, it's a little vague at this point, but I think that there was this, an expression of need that we didn't want to let Representative Walker's bill
Does anybody here still from the DOC who might like to weigh in on getting this, the availability of this information and privacy concerns or anything like that? Or, whether you think this is a good, useful effort or whatever else you want to talk about at this point, I guess.
Madam Chair and members, Dennis Benson again from the Department of Corrections. Obviously, we've had this discussion a couple of times in the last several years. Our position has been, we believe that, at least for the Department of Corrections, we think that the system is very transparent today. It's a very different system than it was in the early 70s when the office was created. There are telephones, there are medias in our institutions, visits, attorney visits, certainly access to U.S. mail. It's a very transparent system compared to what it was 30 years ago. Having said that, if it is the wish of the legislature to do an analysis or a study, we would certainly cooperate, and we aren't threatened by having an outside entity look at our system from a different perspective. We're used to it. In fact, we've worked with the Ombudsman for many, many years. I guess, as I testified in division, my concern would be if you're going to do it at some point, it has to be done right. I think if you're going to add a position or two, it simply doesn't work in a system of 9,000 people. Back when we had a system of 4,000, 4,500, I believe there were 7, 8, or 9 in that office. But we have a grievance system now that we didn't have even 10 years ago that deals with these issues. There are, of course, numerous attorneys. There's a due process system that wasn't there in the 70s when the office was created. So, again, we don't have strong feelings one way or another. We'd certainly work with you. We would question whether or not it's as necessary today as it was when the office originated.
Questions?
Comment, Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Thank you. One of the problems I see with that is that we've chronically underfunded the Human Rights Department, in my judgment, and we've had back a few years, I think, some lawsuits that dealt with that. And so we might get some comment from them, but it seems to me that we'll have to be very careful about anything where we're not providing them with the money.
And I also had a question for Mr. Fitzpatrick, right? Fitzpatrick, I'm sorry. I understand that and I don't know if you're prepared to address that, there's some problems with the department and some cases that the AG's office had that could be cause some financial problems for the department. Is that accurate, or?
Mr. Chair, committee members, we were informed at a point after the our budget submission that the Attorney General had determined that it would no longer do our conciliations, which is something that they had done for about 10 years. And as a result, for us to actually continue doing that as part of our process, that would be an additional cost to us of about $100,000. And so we're at the midst now of trying to figure out how to absorb what was at one time the Attorney General's purview.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't want to jump around too much here, but before Commissioner Benson gets up, because you're kind of getting ready to step away from the table, I just wanted to follow up with where we were before. And I appreciate what you said about the transparency in the department compared to long ago. But what I wanted to ask you is, has there been any kind of outside evaluation done any time in the last several years? Or, it's all... You know, I'm sure you're right that things are much better, but I think it's always a good idea to have some kind of objective evaluation. Has there been anything?
Commissioner Benson?
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, for many years the Department of Corrections complied with the American Corrections Association standards, and we went through that audit process. In fact, our newest institutions are audited and then they're re-audited 3 years later. What we haven't kept pace with is the audit beyond that 3 years later. We stopped doing that during the budget crunch back 4 or 5 years ago, and that's something that the commissioner is looking at starting again. But what we do is we audit each other. We have an audit team that goes to each facility and conducts audits of a variety of things. So we certainly have fire marshals that come in and audit. We have healthcare professionals that come in and audit. We do work with various organizations out there around mental health that they don't actually come in and audit, but we do work with them with respect to ratios of psychiatrists and psychologists to offenders and things like that. But again, to short answer, in recent years, no, there's not an outside entity that comes in.
And Commissioner, when you've had that other, did you say that was the accrediting organization that did that? And there's a cost to the department for that? And what is that cost? And if you could just give us an idea of how extensive that is.
Madam Chair and Representative, the cost, there's a fee, and I believe it was somewhere around $10,000 to $13,000 per institution for our central office. And I believe there was a charge for community services as well. And then our paroling or release authority was also accredited by ACA. So it got to be quite a pile of money. And that was the small cost. The real cost is there are a couple of hundred standards that have to be well documented. So it takes an inordinate amount of staff time to put this together for the auditors to come in and examine. And we did this for about 25 years from the late 70s, well, actually about 25 years, maybe 30 years. So we got to a point where we couldn't get the wheel much rounder, so we felt there was more benefit in doing these audits where we actually integrated not only the ACA standards that speak to everything from how do you store your toxic materials to how do you release offenders to ratios to how much seg time, meals, temperatures, and all of those things. We integrated more and more of the kinds of things that we were having problems with in our facilities, like checking the perimeter security system, We kept a very close eye on food, health care, psychology, mental health, those kinds of things. So we were able to do it inside of our own budget and with our own people for a lot less money.
Representative Lieber.
And Commissioner, how about the topic that's addressed here, though, in the language that the House has about addressing how the department addresses inmate complaints, assaults, deaths, and, well, of course, it wouldn't be county jails for you, but, you know, any death or injury that occurs in the prison system. Is that included?
Sure.
Are you doing that?
Representative,
it's not quite true, Representative Lieber, because they do have oversight over the county jail in terms of doing inspections and that. And this part of this language comes out of the fact that there has been a number of inmates who have died in custody in the county jails, and that was also to be studied by the court.
Okay, well, and then, Commissioner, how about that focusing on that area rather than all these other things about temperatures and toxic materials? How about this? Is there a portion of those other studies or evaluations that went to these questions?
Madam Chair and Representative Leibling, we do analysis. Anytime somebody dies, we have a review board. A review occurs by our health care staff that remains private, similar to the DHS. There's statutory language around that. So in addition to that, we have the coroner. We contract in most cases with the Ramsey County coroner. We have investigators. We have an investigation unit that investigates deaths inside of our facility. If there is a death in a county jail, we have the jail inspection unit that gets involved in. There's a report written if something occurs in the county jail facilities, too, by our jail inspection unit.
I guess I have kind of a basic question for Commissioner Kirkpatrick. Does the Department of Human Rights presently investigate other departments? Is that a function of your department?
Madam Chair, if there is a human rights issue, we in fact do. Other state agencies and or local communities.
So this would be in your purview to actually look at these issues? I mean, I don't want your department to go off and do things that are kind of like not in your scope of you know, your department.
Major, my understanding is we're not really investigating. We're holding a task force to gather information.
Okay.
It's not necessarily an investigation.
And then a report that has to be put together. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps this question is for Representative Paymar or Health Council about the language on page 18, line 20. It says the county jails, workhouses, and prisons. Would that include facilities like St. Peter? Or could that include some of
those? Yeah, Chair, Senator Rosen, that was, I don't believe so, but that's the oversight there is by DHS,
okay.
I believe.
Okay. Other questions? Is that a comment that you'd like to go home and hit your pillow, Senator?
Yes.
Follow. All right. Any other questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it okay to veer off just a little bit and request at some point where in the budget there is matching funds for some of these appropriations, federal matching funds, and maybe find out, have a list of where those are? What appropriations have federal matching funds? That's what I'm trying to ask.
Mr. Turner, Mr. Carver, is that something that you can pull together for us?
Madam Chair and members, yes.
Okay.
Mr.
Turner, we'll tackle that. Okay, thank you. All right, I think we've gotten to the witching hour. I know my brain got to the witching hour quite a while ago. Tomorrow would be the House day to share, and Representative Paymar, if you want to kind of let people know what to plan for or not plan for.
I'm sure I
don't see the
my understanding that we weren't going to meet tomorrow. So just the working group will meet to the policy. We would not meet. And, we will just be sort of fluid here in terms of to get our targets. Maybe we could convene on Saturday. If we could just inform conference committee members tomorrow about our plans or based on what they get, if that's satisfactory.
Very good.
How would the working group
will meet, during the day tomorrow?
You know when we're trying.
Yeah.
Sometime early morning, the working group will meet when we go into caucus to see how much progress that we can make during that time. And we'll be on the floor all day, so we'll just
try to get things.
Our floor session may not work with your caucus time, so we may have to play that one by ear. Okay. Right? Any other questions? For the good of the order, we are adjourned. Thank you all very much for your patience and tolerance of this late hour.